This is primarily where we will be today, Isaiah 47 shortly, and then Revelation 17 through 18. For the visitors, and those who haven't been with us much recently, we are working through Revelation. We are getting close to the end. The short version of where we are is we have walked through everything up through chapter 17. We've spent a lot of time going back to Old Testament prophecies, Old Testament backgrounds, intertestamental backgrounds, New Testament backgrounds. Short version of what we're going to talk about today is going to be chapter 17 and 18, primarily. And it is about the identification of these verses, the identification of the city that must be destroyed because of its idolatry and wickedness and so forth. All right. And so this is Babylon the Great in 17 and 18, the city that must be destroyed by God for the evil that it has done. And so that's what we'll be discussing today. But before we go into that, Isaiah 47, this is a prophecy about historical Babylon. Pop quiz, what year did historical Babylon destroy the city of Jerusalem? Old Testament Babylon. 587 BC. Thank you. Who destroyed the northern kingdom in 722?
Assyria.
Okay, cool. This is going back to that second conquest of the nation that God sent to the nation for their disobedience. 587 and several attacks before that by Babylon. Though Babylon was sent by God, Babylon was also to be judged by God. And that is what this chapter is about. So Isaiah 47. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. For you shall no more be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind flour. Put off your veil. Strip off your robe. Uncover your legs. Pass through the rivers. Your nakedness shall be uncovered, and your disgrace shall be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will spare no one. Our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, is the Holy One of Israel. Sit in silence, and go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called the mistress of the kingdoms. I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage. I gave them into your hand. You showed them no mercy. On the aged, you made your yoke exceedingly heavy. You said, I shall be a mistress forever, so that you did not lay these things to heart or remember their end. Now, therefore, hear this, you lover of pleasures who sit securely, who say in your heart, I am and there is no one besides me. I shall not sit as a widow or know the loss of children. These two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day. The loss of children and widowhood shall come upon you in full measure in spite of your many sorceries and the great power of your enchantments. You felt secure in your wickedness. You said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge led you astray. And you said in your heart, I am and there is no one besides me. But evil shall come upon you, which you will not know how to charm away. Disaster shall fall upon you, for which you will not be able to atone. The ruin shall come upon you suddenly, of which you know nothing. Stand fast in your enchantments and your many sorceries, which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you may be able to succeed. Perhaps you may inspire terror. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let them stand forth and save you. Those who divide the heavens, who gaze at the stars, who at the new moons make known what shall come upon you. Behold, they are like stubble. The fire consumes them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. No coal or warming oneself is this. No fire to sit before. Such to you and those with whom you have labored, who have done business with you from your youth, they wander about, each in his own direction. There is no one to save you. What we're going to read in Revelation 18 quotes from this chapter several times. So there, keep this in mind, and as we read through Revelation 18 and work through it, there'll be a number of places where we'll go, okay, See, this is basically word for word from Isaiah 47, except no longer applied to Old Testament Babylon, now applied to somewhere else. To Revelation. In terms of a little outline of where we've come from, 15 and 16 were the seven bowls, right? Seven bowls and seven plagues. 15 introduces them. 16 goes through the seven bowls. At the very end of 16, in the seventh bowl, on verse 19, the great city. The great city is always Babylon in here. The great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nation fell. And God remembered Babylon the Great to make her drain the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. Okay? So the seventh bowl, the final, the climactic. All right, the final climactic plague comes upon Babylon the Great, and that's 15 and 16. 17 and 18 now focus on that last bowl. 17 and 18 is a discussion of, specifically, Babylon the Great. All right, so you can see it stops and develops. In chapter 17, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on the many waters." And so the seven angels, they give the seven bowls, and one of those seven angels comes to John and says, "I'm going to show you, all right, about this judgment. I just talked about it in the previous bowl. I'm going to show you in detail." And that's 17 and 18. Okay. Top five. All right, here's my top five things in Revelation 17 and 18 to look for if you want to identify who, in verse 1, is the great prostitute. Who is Babylon? Top five. One, all right, whoever she is, she must be devoured. And this is chapter 17, 16 through 17. Okay? Whoever Babylon is, because at this point, all right, at this point, Babylon is not a big deal. Yeah, it's a city in Persia still, but it's not a major player in any of the early church's life. So metaphorically, who is this Babylon supposed to be? Whoever she is, all right, you have to be able to describe her as being devoured. If you look in verses 16 and 17, or start at 15. "And the angel said to me, 'The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the ten horns you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked.'" That should sound a lot like what we just read in Isaiah. "And devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled." So God, even though the beast is anti-God, even though the beast is anti-God, God still uses the beast to destroy the harlot. Right? Okay, well, who's the beast? We've discussed this. And this is very widely believed, whether you are a futurist who believes all of Revelation is in the future, or, as I, you're a preterist who believes at least most of it is in the past. Everyone believes, pretty much, the first beast is Rome. All right, there's the dragon, Satan, and he delegates his power to the first beast, and that is Rome. And even if you're a futurist who believes all of this will come in the future, you believe in something like a future Rome. And so this is still patterned off of old Rome. So whoever the first beast is, that's Rome. All right. In verses 16 and 17, Rome devours the harlot. Okay? So whoever it is, it has to be somebody or something, really, that Rome devours. Second thing. Same verse. Whatever it is, whoever it is when John is alive. All right? Verse 18. "And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the land." Okay? Is, not will be, is. So whoever it is in existence when John is writing. Okay? So in other words, it's not some future city. Okay? Here's a passage we haven't talked about yet. Come out. 18:4. Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." All right. So this has to make sense. This is obviously referring to the Christians. All right. Christians, get out. All right. Separate yourself from this thing, whatever this thing is. All right. Because if you don't, you will be destroyed along with it. So separate yourself out. It's time for its end to come. All right. So that has to make sense. 18:18. The great city. Okay. You'll see that in 18:18. You'll also see it in 18:2. You'll also see it in 17:5. All right. Great city. Great city. Great city. Over and over and over. Okay. So whoever it is, it's called the great city. And if there's clues in Revelation, as you know there are, this will help us identify who this is. And finally, something you start seeing in 17:6. All right. Okay. This shows up many times. 17:6, it talks about she is guilty of the blood of the saints and martyrs. In 18:20, rejoice over her, heavens, you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her. And then in verse 24, and in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the land. Okay. So those are your top five. And this is just five reasons why I'm very convinced. I know this is first century Jerusalem. Why? Well, Rome did not devour itself in the first century. All right. What did Rome devour? Absolutely devoured, destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70. Is, all right, whatever it is, had to be around at the time. This is not some future thing. This is about a destruction in that generation. It is about Jerusalem. 18:4. The Christians are called or said, come out of her. All right? Come out of her. Were the Christians supposed to separate themselves from Rome? Well, in a sense, morally, sure. Right? But they didn't need to separate themselves. They were already separate. The Gentiles were already separate from the Jews. This is remnant language. This is remnant, separate from the others. And when you're using remnant language, you're talking about Christians, separate yourselves from the Jews who do not believe. All right? Or if you go back to, as we often have, to Luke's version of the Olivet Discourse. When Jesus says, when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, what do? You get out. Right? Why? Because if you stay in the city, you will be destroyed like the rest. So, same thing. The great city, 18:18. Going back a few chapters in Revelation, when you have the two prophets. Who is the great city? The great city is spiritually Sodom. The great city is spiritually Egypt. The great city is the place where our Lord was crucified. All right. So the great city in Revelation was the place where our Lord was crucified. And so, well, where was that? Well, we all know where that is. And so here's my top five. There's other things in here. All right. The harlot language. This is mostly applied to Jerusalem and Israel in the Old Testament. There's other things to look to. But this is my top five. So when we're talking today, we're going to be talking about this, the destruction of Jerusalem. Now look at 18. All right. When we read 18, I want you to think of Isaiah. I want you to think of Ezekiel and Jeremiah. I want you to think of the prophets. Revelation seems to me, genre-wise and attitude-wise, seems to me more like any Old Testament book than anything else in the New Testament. It really does. It's like a mixture of Daniel with Ezekiel and Isaiah. All right, it's got apocalyptic, but here you have something that happens a lot in the major prophets, or even in the minor. You've got oracles against the nations. Right? Oracles, and usually when it says oracles against the nations, it's talking about individual cities. Here's about you, Tyre. Here's about you, Edom. Here's about you, Sidon. Here's about you, Babylon, as we just read. 18 is equivalent, Revelation 18, is equivalent to an Isaiah 47 type of prophecy. And quotes it a lot. So let's slowly work through as much of Revelation 18 as we can. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. The earth was made bright with his glory, and he called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place of demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth and the kings of the land have committed immorality with her. And the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living." Okay, so we start with this. And now we're going to, as we go through the chapter, we're going to expand on a lot of these notions. Right? There's a whole section, for example, on merchants. So it says in verse 4, "Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues.'" All right? Don't share in her plagues. Don't experience this. Get out. "For her sins are heaped as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." Her sin is heaped as high as heaven. I can't remember if that's on Isaiah 47 or from Isaiah 14. Also about Babylon. This is a quote, or at least a reference, or an echo of that. "For her sins are heaped as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back as she herself has paid back others. Repay her double for her deeds." Double for her deeds. What Old Testament passage do you think of when you think of Israel having paid double for her deeds? Anybody?
Isaiah 3 or 4.
I believe it's Isaiah 40. But you're absolutely right. It's Isaiah talking. Let's confirm, I guess. Actually, you can go confirm. It's Isaiah talking about bringing Israel back, all right, bringing Israel back from captivity in Babylon. And he says she is paid double for her sin. So it's the same language, just as he applied to Israel 540 years before this point that John wrote this. 40 verse 2. Okay, thank you.
"She hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins."
Same language here, except now it's she's about to receive double for all her sins. "Mix a double portion for her in the cup she mixed." Verse 7. "As she glorified herself and lived in luxury, so gave her a like measure. So give her a like measure of torment and mourning. Since she says in her heart," she says, and now remember what we just read in Isaiah. All right. "I sit as a queen. I am no widow. And mourning I shall never see." Okay. "For this reason, her plagues will come in a single day," just like it was in Isaiah, right? It was that focus on, you think you're fine. No, single day. In other words, short period of time. You're fine, suddenly destruction on you. Same things. "For this reason, her plagues will come in a single day, death and mourning and famine. And she will be burned up with fire." Also was a theme there. For mighty is the Lord God who has judged her. "And the kings of the earth," or the kings of the land, I think this is talking about the Herods, "and the kings of the land who committed sexual immorality and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning." All right. Remember, we talked about this when from Josephus in the lead up to the war. The Herodians, before the war started, were trying to tell the Jews, do not rebel against Rome. All right. Remember, the Herods are always, if there's ever a choice, Jews or Romans, the Herods are always Roman. All right. They always go with them. And why? Because they knew where their power came from. They knew where their wealth came from and their influence. And so before the war was started, they were trying to tell the Jews, don't rebel. This is not going to work out well for you. And when they did rebel, the Herods left the Jews, joined Vespasian and then Titus to take the country back. And so why? Well, you know what? If you happen to be the rulers of Israel, all right, under the Romans, and you know they're about to come and wipe out your country, when you gain your power back, you're going to know it's going to be bad. This is going to be devastating. They're going to destroy my capital. Still, they sided with the Romans. But the Herods, when they see this, they're going to be like, I'm going to have to rebuild this whole thing. Very sad. Very, very sad. And the kings of the earth who committed sexual immorality and lived in luxury, back to verse 9, with her, will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, alas, alas, you great city, you mighty city, Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet cloth, all kinds of scented wood, all kinds of articles of ivory, all kinds of articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and slaves, that is, human souls. Okay? The fruit for which you longed for has gone from you, and all your delicacies and your splendors are lost to you, never to be found again. There's going to be more about the merchants here. Let's talk about that theme real quick. All right? It's something I've learned in this study as I dug into what Herod did and what their, you know, their building projects and whatnot. Remember talking about Caesarea Maritima? Caesarea Maritima. Does anybody know what that is? Right. It's a city built by Herod. City built by Herod on the sea. That's why it's called Caesarea, because it's built in honor of Caesar, right? Herod loved the Caesars. They all did. Caesarea Maritima, by the sea. Caesarea Maritima, and I didn't know this at the beginning. It would have helped me a lot, because I thought this whole passage was just metaphorical, because a lot of this comes from a prophecy against Tyre in Ezekiel. I thought this was just metaphorical, but it's really not, because, as at least some people say, Caesarea Maritima, after Herod built it, became the most influential, the richest port in all of the Mediterranean. All right, if that's the case, right? You've got Caesarea Maritima. What's that really provide access to in terms of commerce? Well, it provides access to Israel and the neighboring areas there. What's going to happen to commerce when Rome comes into a country to completely destroy it? None, right? No commerce. Well, let's trade with Jerusalem. Oh, we can't. It's currently surrounded by an army, right? That kind of thing. And so, yeah, this actually perfectly fits. And before, I just thought, well, it's just metaphorical. And I'm like, no, actually, historically, this works, because Caesarea Maritima was a major, major Roman world port. All right, back to verse 15. The merchants of these wares, who gained wealth from her, will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas, for the great city that was clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels and with pearls. In it, for in a single hour, once again that theme, in a single hour, all this wealth has been laid waste. Well, is it a single hour or is it a single day? I mean, it's neither. It's a short period of time. It's a manner of speech. And all shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors and all whose trade is on the sea, stood far off and cried as they saw the smoke of her burning. What city is like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, alas, alas, for the great city, where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth. For in a single hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her. Okay. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea. Interesting enough, millstone shows up in the prophecy on Babylon that we read. It shows up differently in that there it shows up as you are the great queen. You're above these things, these worrying about your own food. Well, take off your veil and start working the millstone, because you're about to be judged. That was the context in 47. This is more like what happens when you hang a stone around someone's neck and throw them in the sea as Jesus says in the Gospels. And what's the reason for that? Well, if you lead any of my people astray, it would be better for you if a millstone was tied around your neck and you're thrown into the sea. And that is exactly why this fits very well. What's the problem with Jerusalem? Well, they did try to lead the people astray. So then a mighty angel took a stone, like a great millstone, and threw it into the sea, saying, "So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence, and will be found no more. And the sound of harpists and musicians, of flute players and trumpeters will be heard in you no more. And the craftsmen of any craft will be found in you no more. And the sound of the mill will be found in you no more. And the light of a lamp will shine in you no more. And the voice of bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more. For your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints, and of all who have been slain on earth." This theme comes up a lot in Revelation, of the martyrs of Jesus, of those being slain. Remember, from a New Testament perspective, all right? From a New Testament perspective, who is the persecutor of the church? It's not Rome. It really wasn't until right about this time that there was any persecution by Rome. Who is the persecution of the saints? When Peter stands at Pentecost and gives his sermon, what does he say? Those terrible Romans, right? No, they didn't say that, right? What did he say? He said, "You crucified the Christ by the hands of lawless men." The Romans were the tools in the hands, right? Not because the Jews had control of them, but because they manipulated Pilate, right? Remember that? They manipulated Pilate. Pilate did not want to crucify Jesus. That was really clear from the gospel narratives. He thought Jesus was an okay guy, right? I'm sure he thought he was kind of weird, because he was a Roman and Romans didn't like Jews that much. But he did not want to crucify Jesus. And he was really forced into it. That's always the theme. That's what the theme is in Acts as well. And when it comes to this, the lingo that you see here, when it talks about prophets, saints, and whatnot, when it's talking about prophets, right, I think this is meant to point us to this long history of Israel, right, being martyrs of the prophets. Remember when Jesus talked to, he was talking to either the Sadducees or the Pharisees, or both at the time. And he's talking to them about the prophets. And he says, "You guys, you make tombs and monuments for the prophets. All right? But your parents are the ones who killed them. All right? So you honor them now, but it's your ancestors that were the murderers of the prophets." And so this right here is, I think, the climactic point of chapter 18, right? What's the last bit? "And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints, and of all who have been slain on the land," all right, on the earth. Let's talk about the land of Israel. This is it, all right? God's been saving it up. You see that in the image of, what about Israel's sins? Her sins have been building up, piling up, reaching as high as heaven. That shows up here in other things. It's time, in other words. It had been delayed. And that's the same idea you get in the Olivet Discourse when Jesus talks about the temple, right? He says, what's going to happen to all these... Remember this discussion, like the disciples are looking at the temple and going, "Wow, this is amazing." And the temple really was, from ancient accounts, outside of Judaism, really beautiful. White stones, covered in gold, all right? And no, we're talking about the disciples who are mostly like fishermen, all right? Country, a lot of country guys. And so they go into Jerusalem and see the temple and they go, "Wow, this is amazing. Isn't this great, Jesus?" And Jesus says, all of that's about to be torn down. Within this generation, all of that is going to be destroyed for Israel's sins. All right? This is that subject matter. Make sense? All right, so that's 17 and 18. We actually spent some time on 17 and 18 months ago. And so we went through it kind of fast this time. Any questions about that before we go back? And I want to look a little bit at chapter 17 again to bring it back to Isaiah, unless you guys have discussion things. Yes, Chip.
It also brings to mind the parable of the light of the vineyard tubes.
Mm-hmm. It does. Like the one in Luke we were just discussing of what happens when you have an olive tree that doesn't bear fruit. Let's just tear it out. All right? We just talked about this, what, 2 Sundays ago? No, don't tear it out yet. Dig a trench around it. Give it a little time. And then if it doesn't, then yeah, get rid of it and use this land for something else. Or the parable of the vineyard, right? Because there's multiple versions of this, because Israel is the vine. The parable of the vineyard where there's the owner of the vineyard and he sends his servants to those who's renting out the vineyard to, and they beat the servants. And then he sends more servants and he beats those servants too. Of course, these servants are the prophets in the parable. And he keeps sending servants, and the vineyard owner's like, you know what? They'll listen to my son if I send him. And so he sends the son. And what do? They kill the son. All right? They kill the son. And so then what is the vineyard owner going to do? Well, naturally, what you would expect he would do, he would say, okay, you didn't listen to my servants. You killed my son. I'm going to bring destruction on you. So, it's very much like that same thing, which is very common. Once you know to look for it, you see it all. You see it all sorts of places in the gospel. Jennifer, what were you going to say?
I was under the impression that when they refer to sexual morality, it's religious unfaithfulness by people.
Mm-hmm.
So in 18:9, all the kings of the earth made sexual morality and lived in luxury with her.
Mm-hmm.
Is that other nations bringing in their religions and
I can think of 3 separate ways to take it. All right, I'll tell you how I take it and why. One, you could go back to the Old Testament precedents, right? And I think you're absolutely right. That's when it talks about a city committing sexual immorality, it's not that it is not a city committing sexual immorality. That doesn't make any sense. When this is applied to Jerusalem in the Old Testament about committing sexual immorality, it can at least mean one of 2 things and often overlapping. One is Jerusalem and the people in general depending on foreign nations for protection, right? Because this comes up where the prophets will talk to the king and say, don't make an alliance with those guys. God will protect you, right? And what do the kings do? Well, generally because they're wicked, they go make alliances, all right? And so that is called by the prophets immorality because it views Israel as a city and as a woman being immoral with the other nations. The other one, like you just said, would be talking about not just political immorality, but also spiritual in the sense of bringing in idolatry, which, of course, also Jerusalem did have problems with in the Old Testament. Now, if we bring this into the New Testament, how would you apply this? Well, you've got Israel in the land under subjugation or under control by Rome, at least until they rebel. Then they're briefly, very briefly free. So what about that? Well, what was Israel supposed to do? Israel was supposed to trust in God to deliver her. What did Israel do? Israel rebelled against God. Israel also said, right, if we go back to the trial of Jesus, whenever Pilate is trying to let Jesus go, Israel says in her leadership, "Let crucify him, let his blood be on us and on our children," right? That is spiritual adultery, plain and simple right there. 2, you could talk about how Israel was very friendly with all the nations around it, especially through her leaders. Herod and his progeny, they were prolific builders, especially Herod. Herod was a huge builder, but not just a builder in Israel. He was a builder. He built lots of monuments and paid for lots of pagan things in other pagan cities. Idolatry. So that's certainly true of Israel through her leadership. That was very common. So you could take it that way, as in Israel was idolatrous in that sense. That's not really the way I take it. But that totally fits and still fits with all the other things that we've seen. What I think when it talks about kings of the earth here, it's that same thing we've discussed many times. You've got 2 words for earth, All right? In Revelation. And the one here is the one that's talking about the land, not the one that's talking about the Roman Empire. And so I really do take this as the Herods, as those, that family that has ruled over her since the first century under the blessing and protection of the Romans. But that's how I take it. But it's not necessary that you do so. So that's essentially what that theme means. Yeah.
So if the leaders are the ones committing immorality,
mm-hmm.
does that mean they're the ones, or
not, because they led the other ones astray?
Shouldn't it not be the people, because they're not the ones doing it, and they can't exactly tell the leaders what to do or not? So
actually, they should. All right, and sometimes they did. Sometimes the Jews stood up against their leaders. All right, remember the Maccabean revolt. Right, remember this would be 2nd century BC. This would be where the Seleucids, which is a Greek empire, was ruling the country, and Antiochus IV Epiphanes basically told the Jews, "You're gonna be Greek now." And started slaying pigs on altars, sending people to cities, remember that? And saying, "You, Jews, you're no longer Jews. You can't circumcise your kids anymore. And you have to now do all these pagan things." And what did some of the Jews do? Well, some of them, those who led the Maccabean revolt, said no and fought back and ultimately won their independence. In other words, what they said is, "We're going to follow God's commands, all right? Even if we have to die, we're going to follow God's commands." And they looked at Phinehas, right, from the Old Testament as their example, all right? Phinehas, meaning there had been Jerusalemites or Israelites intermarrying with foreigners, and God was going to judge them. And what did Phinehas do? He saw it in action, grabbed a spear, ran into the tent, speared him through, right? Phinehas. And what did God do because of Phinehas' action? God said, "Okay, I will relent." And so the Maccabees, they took that as an example, and they said, "No, we are not going to in any way, all right, we are not going to any way do this kind of thing." That is something the Jews should have consistently done toward Herod and Rome. But, as you see, right, whenever God sends his son to the vineyard, what do? They use the Roman apparatus.
So it is
kind of
fault if leaders are still committing immorality.
It is. It's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. Right? It takes two to tango, as they say.
I was thinking, with the leaders being all-powerful-ish, mm-hmm. if the people revolt, they can just bring a bunch of Romans in and wipe them off the face of the earth.
They could. And you know, Herod had his own troops, and Herod and his children did sometimes murder large numbers of Jews. Because mm-hmm. they were evil, for sure. And so there's the Jews should have always stood up to Herod, and sometimes did, sometimes didn't. All right? And of course, the leaders of Israel, the Herodian dynasty, should have been faithful to God, but they weren't. They were all very friendly towards pagan idolatry. And so both are messed up. All right? Both are very, very messed up in all this situation, which is why the remnant needs to come out of that group. Right? It's the small number. You need to get out of there, so you do not take part in her sins, but also in her plagues. All right? Get out of her so you don't do the sins that she does, but also get out of her so the seven bowls don't fall on you. Because you're supposed to survive through this. And they did. And they did actually leave. Any other thoughts? Questions?
So wasn't the Herods appointing the priests too? So they weren't even mm-hmm. the legitimate line of...
Right. It was during Herod, either Herod or his father Antipater's reign, that the Herods took over appointing the priesthood in Jerusalem. And so no longer of the very small line of high priests that come out of the Old Testament, back to that very long 3 or 4 Sunday discussion we had when we surveyed the Old Testament and the priesthood. But yeah, the Herods were even corrupting and controlling the temple. It was all corrupt all over the place, from both the leadership standpoint of the Jews, from the Roman standpoint, because the leaders of the Jews were more Roman than they were Jewish in their sensibilities. And the Jews themselves, or at least most of them, not all of them, right? Some of them believed, Right? The remnant survived. The remnant left. Right? And that's who John's writing to. He's writing his letter. Who's he writing? He's writing it to the remnant. He's writing it to those who should survive this. Any other thoughts? Okay. Romans 17 and 18. If you want to discuss any more of this during lunch or later, let me know. Okay? Perhaps we'll come back and hit on some things on 18 next Lord's Day. Perhaps. Otherwise, we'll start in on chapter 19. Let me know later if you have any questions. Kim, will you please pray for us?